welcome to the Conference on World Affairs. And I hope you've enjoyed the winter and summer over the last 24 hours. We're back to summer, so that's a good thing for today. Today is Thursday, April 11th. It's 11 o'clock, and this panel number 3207, titled Ripped from the Headlines, International Edition. I hope you're in the right spot. My name is Thomas Gibb. I'm the moderator today, and we have an esteemed panel here to discuss the wide-ranging topic of international headlines and international news. The way we're going to do this is I'll just give a brief sort of introduction of each one of the panelists, and then we'll move on to questions. Because we have four panelists, we're going to use most of the time for discussion and questions from the audience. So those of you that have been to other sessions know we have a CWA app that you can put onto your phone. And from that app, you can ask questions. I'll receive the questions on my phone here, and we can distribute those to the panelists. If you don't have the app or you prefer to go analog and write your questions, Melanie has some note cards that she'll pass around, and you can write the questions. She's right there in the red shirt. You can write the questions on the note cards. Okay? So, first of all, we have our panelist, Professor Kim, who brings great street credibility to this panel. He's been a journalist on TV, and he's also been a producer and a journalist in the field, reporting from hotspots around the world, including Iraq, Sri Lanka, and Kashmir. So, welcome.
Thank you.
And Alexander Verbeek is also somebody who brings another dimension to this discussion. He's a diplomat, a public policy specialist, and also a social media ninja with an amazing following to amplify his voice around environmental concerns, climate change, and other issues. So, welcome. And David Bierce is here, and he's a professor here at CU, as well as Mr. Kim. He teaches political science and international affairs, and has an interesting mix of research and teaching topics ranging from the political economy to how international organizations can reduce conflict around the world, among other things, which we'll get into. And Bob Dreyfus is an independent investigative journalist living in Cape May, but enjoying Boulder this week, I hope. Bob has reported in Mother Jones, the Rolling Stone. He's also been on many talk shows on Fox News, MSNBC, and other outlets discussing world events and conflict around the world. So we've got an interesting group of people here, and we'd like to talk about international news, the media, journalism. So I'll open it up to anybody who has questions for our panelists. Let me see if there's any questions in here yet. There's no questions in here yet. But what I'll pose to the panelists here is this is a panel talking about international news. And in the U.S. right now, with the domestic political situation, we're doing a lot of navel gazing here in the U.S., and we don't pay much attention to the international news. And I'm wondering what's happening around the world that people should be aware of and should pay attention to.
As Leon Trotsky said, you may not be interested in war, but war is interested in you. So that's my opening.
Would you like to write down a question?
I'm okay if people get up and ask them. Do we have to write them down? I mean,
yeah.
If people want to get up,
please.
And keep your questions, that's great.
Okay.
Yeah,
have three comments. No, just kidding.
Yeah.
if you want to start with Assange's arrest today.
I spent a year writing for The Nation about the Trump-Russia story. I did a column weekly about the whole investigation by Robert Mueller, which maybe we can talk about more in a little bit, what it all means in the coming, release of the report, I guess, next week. Julian Assange was a hero for a lot of people on the left when he was doing the Iraq version of WikiLeaks and releasing diplomatic cables about the wars all over the world and from Saudi Arabia and elsewhere. But he became like a curious character and ended up looking more and more like a collaborator, overt collaborator with Vladimir Putin. It's obvious that the information that the Russians stole from John Podesta and from the DNC, which Mueller has explained in great detail in an indictment of various Russian hackers, right, ended up in Assange's paws, and he then was one of the internet outlets for those that release, which became obviously a huge factor in the election. He's mentioned in the Russian part of Robert Mueller's indictments as who identified him as having contacts with some of the hackers, even though he denies. With a lack of credibility that the information came from Russia. Maybe it was laundered through a third party, but of course it came from Russia and ended up at WikiLeaks. He's also been charged as a rapist. I don't know the story about that, but he's a strange character and he's being extradited. So I think it would be fascinating to see what the trial would bring and reveal. I think there's a huge amount of information yet to emerge about the Russia-Trump story, even though we haven't seen the report yet.
We have another question? Yeah?
So getting back to whether or not he's a strange character, isn't that ultimately irrelevant to the information that he released and the fact that he's a journalist being extradited and potentially tried for doing what journalists are supposed to do?
Well, I don't mean other people. I don't consider, there's a dividing line between journalism and propaganda and working as an intelligence agent. I'm a journalist. If I get a leak from somebody, I'm happy to print it if I can verify it or have some notion that it's correct or believable, or at least I'll identify it as questionable, but here's what I learned. It's different when you actively collaborate and, in fact, encourage people to break the law in hacking and then leaking the information. That's what the issue would be. If all he did was receive stolen information and release it, I don't think there's a likelihood that he can be convicted of a crime. But, the definition of journalism has been stretched all over the map these days, right? I don't consider Sean Hannity to be a journalist. He's a propagandist. I don't consider Julian Assange to be a journalist, based on what I know about his work. That doesn't mean that if he has truthful information, we ought to analyze it. But it has to be analyzed in the context of where it came from, who he is, why he released it. That's part of the story, not just the objective facts. And I'll close by saying that the emails that he actually released in 2016 really didn't say a whole lot. They got huge media attention, but it wasn't like they revealed some desperate scandals or wrongdoing or anything. They were just, thousands of emails that kind of, in my opinion, said almost nothing.
Thank you, Bob. We have a question from the app here. And please, when you submit a question, will you let me know if you're a student or a community member? We're trying to prioritize questions from students. This is a question perhaps for Mr. Kim to answer first, and then we'll open it up to the other panelists. Do you think that the relationship between the current administration and North Korea will be more helpful or harmful in the long run?
My first question back to you is, were you interested in promoting relations with North Korea before they started threatening us with nuclear weapons? I don't think we are very much interested, keeping good relationship with dictatorial regimes like North Korea, Venezuela, and other countries. It was a dramatic turn in 2017 when South Korean presidential delegation visited the White House and met President Trump and conveyed the message from North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un that he was interested in studying about it. After they had started threatening the U.S. with nuclear weapons. And do you remember that the North Korean government news agency announced that, hey, we have successfully tested nuclear weapons, even including hydrogen bomb. And it was like a close to thermonuclear war between the United States and North Korea at the time. And at the time, I was thinking to myself, what is he doing in the North? I mean, does he think he can fire ICBM to major cities in the U.S., including Denver, Colorado? Because Pyongyang regime included some of the targets, including Denver. And I thought, they should be smart enough that once they do it, within days, there will be a retaliation, and North Korea will be disappearing from the world map. But anyway, that was the beginning. And President Trump, coming from business background, and he even wrote the famous book, Art of Deal. So he wanted to open a dialogue. The problem is, as we have seen in two Trump-Kim summit, first in Singapore, the second in Hanoi, Vietnam. They've been meeting. They agreed in principle that we are going to start good relationship with North Korea and the United States. But we haven't achieved much. And there are three things I can tell you with certain confidence. Number one, by promoting this friendly dialogue with North Korea's Kim Jong-un. One, North Korea is not going to give up its nuclear weapons. Number two, United States may have no other options but continue this, because using military option will mean it will jeopardize 10 million population in South Korea, which is only 30 miles from the national border between North and the South. Because once there is any preemptive strike from the United States, Pyongyang regime keep threatening, they will explode nuclear weapons. If not, they can do it in the United States, they will just do it in Seoul, South Korea.
Professor Beers, would you like to have a word?
Right. I think the question was something about, will this Trump opening to North Korea be helpful or harmful? And I guess my reaction here, and by the way, I'm not a journalist, I'm a political scientist, so this is where the answer is coming from, is, in truth, I don't have a problem with the Trump administration trying to open discussions with North Korea. I think the concern with the Trump administration is, what sorts of concessions would he make on behalf of the United States government to continue this? And I completely agree with what my colleague here just said. North Korea is not going to give up nuclear weapons under any circumstances. And so negotiating to get rid of these is It's just not going to happen. But I'd actually go even further, and I want to say this carefully, is I'm not sure that North Korean nuclear program is particularly threatening to the United States. They launch missiles, but we have nuclear deterrence. I think I understand why a North Korea regime would seek to develop, I don't like it, but I understand why they would do this. I don't believe they would launch on or even over U.S. military facilities because they know what the U.S. response would be. So I think this is a situation where we're going to probably have to accept that they are going to have nuclear weapons for the foreseeable future. And there may be other things that we can talk about to try to improve the relationship there. But we will forever, I think, be dealing with a nuclear North Korean state.
Thank you. And we have a couple of questions on this topic, and one has asked Mr. Verbeek to answer, and this is on Brexit. Can you speculate about the Brexit issue, particularly the potential end of the Grand European Experiment?
Well,
a light question for
This is not for beginners. Brexit, where are we? The latest thing that happened is that the EU agreed on a further extension of the deadline. Not as much as most EU countries wanted, but France and a couple of others were hitting the brake and said, this absolute mess in UK politics, we cannot bear that any longer. We need to come to a decision. So they took Halloween as a very... very appropriate date as a kind of cutoff date. So the UK politics has managed since the referendum in 2016 to get itself in a kind of impossible position where there's no traditional kind of left or right division. It goes through all the parties, whether you're supporting Brexit or not. For party political reasons, Cameron promised this referendum. It made him win the elections, but he put the UK then in a kind of downward spiral of politics in which they are stuck at the moment. What has changed is that we now know much more about Brexit, what you would normally do before a referendum. To give one example, the Good Friday Agreement that makes it impossible to really step out of the EU without, let's say, kind of hard Brexit form. Nobody ever spoke about the Good Friday Agreement in 2016. Nobody had really thought about it. Maybe a few people, but it was not a big thing in the media. What strangely didn't change, now that we've seen all the political arguments and the economic arguments that it's actually not good for the UK to step out, what has not really changed is the division of how the people would vote. If you would do a new referendum, it would now likely be a small majority supporting staying in the EU, but it all depends on what question you ask, and that's of course the problem with a referendum. So the situation now, speculating a bit, I mean, you can talk for hours about this, but I don't think Theresa May would get agreement on the same agreement amongst in Parliament on the same agreement that she has tried so many times before. She can only put down that same EU agreement on the table all the time. So then it could be a hard Brexit before, what's the date, 1st of June, 1st July, I'm mixing up those dates, I think 1st June. There's hardly anybody is supporting that. So then they probably muddle on until in autumn. And then if they still haven't solved it, it might actually become a hard Brexit, which is very bad for the UK and which bad for... It will affect everybody in the EU, and it will also, the end score will also be negative for the EU as our strengths together. We need each other, But the one that will be hurt most is the UK, and this is really a self-inflicted wound, and it's the stupidity of the whole thing is just, I have no other word for it than call it stupidity.
Let's leave it there. Okay. David, you wanted to respond to Bob? Do you have a comment on Brexit?
Yeah, I do. If we step back a little bit and put it in context, it's inevitably bound up tightly with the Trump election in 2016. They reinforced each other, and of course Trump, when he was running for president, supported and then endorsed and praised the Brexit vote, and vice versa. And a number of overlaps with both the Trump and Russia sides of this equation. Earlier this week, I was on a panel about the rise of populism in the alt-right. It's clear that the centrifugal forces in Europe, kind of, you know, pushing all the countries apart from each other and aiding the rise of the extreme right in Europe, from neo-Nazi parties to ultra-nationalist parties and anti-immigrant fanatics and so forth, was part and parcel of the Brexit vote. Just the way Trump scared Americans with lies and falsehoods about immigration and Muslims, the Brexit vote was partly a British reaction of paranoia and xenophobia. And maybe the Brits are having second thoughts. I have no idea. I don't know about England. I think maybe Americans are having buyer's remorse about electing a billionaire who lives on Fifth Avenue as well. But it's also very clear, there's a new movie that just came out called The Brink, this documentary where Alison Klayman, the filmmaker, followed Steve Bannon around the world, of course, one of the engineers of Trump's victory and a supporter of Brexit, who's been traveling all over Europe, meeting with the Italian fascists, meeting with the Polish far right, meeting with Dutch and Belgian and French National Front, and of course, with Nigel Farage and the Brexit people, and planning what he calls the movement, right, for the EU elections, which happen next month, to create a European-wide coalition of fascists, white nationalists, anti-immigrant fanatics. So this is serious, serious stuff. This is not just a dumb move by the Brits. This is one step down the road to a worldwide fascist movement led by Donald Trump, led by Steve Bannon and their allies in Europe, with the very quiet support of the Russians, who are overjoyed over the fact that Europe could break apart.
Okay. David, did you?
Yeah, I was going to give a slightly different answer to a question that I heard, something about this Brexit going to end the grand European experiment. And as an international political economist trying to look at the big picture, I'm going to say something I think may upset my European colleague here. But I think for the European experiment, the current Brexit mess is potentially a positive development for two reasons. One, the European Union gets rid of a country, the United Kingdom, that has, I think, historically been a break on European integration. United Kingdom had a nice deal in the European Union. They were not even participating in the Economic Monetary Union. They got a big rebate. So they are not even net payers to the system. So as I talk about European integration to my students, the drivers of it, France and Germany, and Britain has been this country with its foot kind of on the brake or hand over the emergency brake. So fine. It's not that there will not be short-term economic costs to Europe, but if one wants to further integrate, it will be easier without the United Kingdom. And I think the second potentially long-term positive development is this is a mess. And I think the likelihood of another EU country saying, we want to do what Britain did, is unlikely. So EU membership, I think, it's going to reduce from, 28 to 27, but I don't think it's going to go down much further in the near term.
Okay, one quick follow-up, and then we'll go to another question.
Just very briefly on the second point. That is, of course, exactly why
the EU is doing what it's doing.
Yep. We want to give a signal to the others, you know. This is not like, you know, a subscription to a magazine or a membership of a golf club, yep, where you can just go in and out. you're either in it or you're not. So that's why we don't make it too easy. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. So careening across the world to Latin America, we have a question from a student asking to have a conversation about developments in Venezuela. It has fallen out of the headlines lately, but it seems like there's a stalemate between who will ascend to power. And I'll add that there's a great humanitarian crisis surrounding Venezuela as well. So does anybody feel passionately about answering that and opening up some discussion?
Although I'm not an area expert in Latin America, but I just want to open up a dialogue with some of my colleagues. United States wanted to have allies in Latin America, and our experience has been since the late 1950s, Cuba became communism. And it lasted almost half a century until we have seen some, promotion of friendship and the opening of the doors. And during the last presidency of Barack Obama, we came very close to normalizing the relationship with Cuba. Venezuela, more than a decade, it has been anti-American, and also what is interesting is the country, just like many countries in Europe and elsewhere, has been ruled by a very interesting populist politician. And, the predecessor to current president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, he was an anti-American figure. And, we all know that President Trump's White House officially announced that we don't acknowledge the current president as a legitimate leader of the country. Now, the politician we recognize as the due and the legitimate president, but he's still struggling within his own country, and the country is still in chaos. But the classic scenario, based on our own modern history, is there any Venezuelan military coup d'etat? So that there's another upheaval that will probably turn into a more happy ending scenario for us. But everything is in mess. And what I read this morning is the Secretary of State and Vice President went to UN asking the United Nations to recognize the challenging politician as the legitimate president of Venezuela. And we don't know what is going to happen in the next few weeks.
Yeah, I think, I'm not a Venezuela expert. Maybe people in the audience know more than I do. But it's, to me, outrageous that the United States would recognize an upstart politician to replace the elected head of another government just because we don't like the guy. The United States has no business at all even hinting at the idea of military action. I hoped we had learned our lesson in Iraq, but this administration seems incapable of learning even kindergarten-level lessons about international policy. Maduro, I don't like him. Neither did I like Saddam Hussein. But in either case, we had no business. We have no business trying to insert ourselves into the politics of another country that's anti-American. Furthermore, the notion that Trump is now using Venezuela as an example of failed socialism and then linking that to the Democrats, who is becoming the campaign theme of 2020, accusing the Democrats of trying to turn the United States into Venezuela, is beyond ridiculous. Putting sanctions on Venezuela to worsen a dire crisis of food and health in that country is, we tried that in Iraq after 1991. Hundreds of thousands of people died, and Madeleine Albright said that's the price you pay. And that, of course, accomplished nothing in the 12 years between the two Iraq wars.
So what are we trying to do there? What business of it is ours? How is it possible that Americans could tolerate this kind of approach? The Monroe Doctrine, God bless President Monroe, but he's long dead. It's a stupid idea to say that we own the Americas. We need to be a humble power. And this is an arrogant reaction by administration that is so far right, so imperialist-minded, that it's, to me, beyond belief that we're even talking about this stuff.
David?
So I guess I would disagree a little bit with my colleague here. If I try to put Venezuela into a larger context of the political economic instability in Latin America, so we're facing a border crisis, for example, which is not streams of Venezuelans coming. But nonetheless, one of the arguments that has been made about the current border crisis is the United States needs to play a bigger effort in the Americas to try to create a stable situation. And if we want people in El Salvador, Guatemala to stay in their countries, then the situation needs to be better. So in truth, I don't have a big problem with the notion that we would want to facilitate regime change in Venezuela. My problem would come with how we might do it. And I agree with my colleague here that I don't think military intervention is likely to go well either for the situation there or for U.S. image in Latin America. But I think the idea of recognizing the challenger politician in hopes that perhaps the Venezuelan military will do something like what happened in Sudan last night is a way of getting involved that does not bring American military forces into Venezuela. And if the situation in Venezuela gets a lot worse, well, there will be additional refugee problems, maybe not coming to the U.S. border, but in the region. And in as much as per Monroe Doctrine, this is our backyard, I think we do have some responsibilities here.
Yeah, I want to strongly disagree with that, if I might, in polite terms. Number one, there is no border crisis. So you referred to the border crisis that we're facing. This is an absurd propaganda ploy by the Trump administration. If you look at the simple data, in 2000, there were hundreds of thousands of people picked up at the border. It was recently down. Last year, I think it averaged, 25 or 30,000. I'm talking about monthly figures. It's now risen to somewhere in the 50 to 60 range or so. This is not a border crisis, so we have no border crisis. Second, we should have learned that when we bombed Libya illegally, illegal intervention, unilateral in Libya, we created a crisis that led to a refugee problem in Europe. And we led to thousands and thousands of people being slaughtered in that country because we decided we didn't like Gaddafi. When we encouraged the rebellion in Syria, and instead of being quiet because the Obama administration thought incorrectly that Assad was about to fall, just like other leaders in the Arab Spring fell, we created a refugee crisis in Europe, and 500,000 people are dead in Syria because the United States got involved beginning in 2011, and I know a lot about this. We helped cause that crisis. So the two biggest civil wars that are feeding refugees into Europe, we are responsible for. The United States is to blame. And so if we think now that we can go into Venezuela, and it's like the mistake we made in Iraq. We thought, oh, well, we'll get rid of Saddam Hussein, everything will be hunky-dory, and we'll have democracy. There's no predicting what's going to happen if there's a military coup, either in Sudan, by the way, we don't know what's going to happen there. South Sudan, which split off from Sudan, is now engulfed in a horrible genocidal crisis. You tell me where we are in Sudan a year from now, you don't know, nobody knows. If the military takes over in Venezuela, will there be a civil war? Will there be armed rebellions by pro-Chavez, pro-Maduro militias. We don't know. It's not our job to go barging into these countries and telling them that we want to reshape them in our image. I'm sorry.
Okay. Professor Kim has a quick reply.
I think the United States should be very cautious when trying to get itself involved in Latin American politics, because the history tells us that we have made this numerous intervention in international affairs in Guatemala and other countries in Latin America. And also during the 1960s, the U.S. government deeply intervened in South Vietnamese military coup d'etat that killed President Ngo Diem at the time. So what I was just wondering when I just learned that President Trump and the White House sided with the Juan Guaido, who is a challenging politician in Venezuela. Wow, that was a quite impressive move for President Trump, because I always thought populist politicians in many countries in Europe, and including President Trump himself, have had a very ambivalent attitude toward dictators and totalitarian regimes. So that's why President Trump has been maintaining good relations with Vladimir Putin, although he ordered the Russian military to invade Ukraine. And also, when there was some debate about North Korea, how to deal with the country, it was the first American president in modern history who was willing to talk to North Korea's dictator. Now, President Trump made it clear Nicolas Maduro should go. He's a dictator. He spoiled the country. Now we need a democratic leader. And so what I'm asking to U.S. government, if I may, be consistent. Be consistent. Which side you are for democracy, dictatorship, totalitarianism? So that's my question.
We can always hope for consistency. We'll keep pushing.
In the right direction.
Another interesting fact is Juan Guaido looks a lot like Beto O'Rourke to me. It's kind of ironic. We're going on to another question, and this is going to start with our one panelist that currently resides outside the United States in the world out there. And the question is, how does the international media portray the Trump administration, and how does it cover the Trump administration? Does it cover it more than other presidents? How is he perceived outside of the U.S.? Well,
you guys really want to know? Any serious media I read internationally writes about President Trump in a way that is difficult to take him serious. At least that's how it started in the first year. But increasingly, I think the tone is changing in a kind of deeply worried state, the way good journalists have always written about fascism. It's the same tone you find here. Putting children in cages in the country that stands for freedom. What is happening in this country? Where has America gone? The America that twice came to help of Europe, 1917, and later in late 1941, when America was the decisive force to liberate those countries that were suffering first under warfare and second in the Second World War under fascist regimes, and was fighting fascism, and gave freedom to all those countries that are now the European Union. Where did this go wrong? Somewhere at a certain moment, we were just talking about it in the earlier debate, after, let's say, the 1960s, so often the U.S., with their fantastic reputation, being the biggest and the most forceful country in the world, standing up for other people's freedom, increasingly played the role of intervening in the wrong way, I mean, we spoke about things like Vietnam and Iraq, etc. But think about Latin America. Take something like Salvador Allende in Chile in 1973. Yes, the guy was left-wing, but he was democratically elected by the majority of the population by honest and fair elections. And then the U.S. kicked him out, puts in a dictator who's been torturing his people for decades, and finally it's now back in a normal democracy. There was no reason to do that, and there are so many more of those examples. So often the interventions are going wrong. War is something that is an absolute last drastic measure that you can take if nothing else has worked. And the outcome of war is always extremely difficult to predict. And we've seen that so often. Take the Iraq War. Walking in Iraq, conquering the country, of course the U.S. can do it. But what do you do afterwards? How do you rebuild the country? Those kind of questions need to be answered before you do something. And what I'm afraid of is that when the next elections comes, it might be to the advantage of the sitting administration to be at war, especially with a weak country. Because it has been proven in the past that you get all this nationalist feeling, as if it is some kind of football game that you're cheering for your party. And that might be a path that the U.S. is on. And it's very unpredictable what the population will do at that moment. So how do other countries write about Donald Trump? Well, the media is very worried about what's happening in your country. And there's a lot of attention for the U.S. Is it more than in the past? I don't know. In the days that, let's say, the previous government of Obama, of course, being the most forceful country in the world, there's always countries look a lot at America. And let's say in the Obama days, there was a lot of criticism on decisions that the U.S. took, but not so consistently as of every single step that takes place every day in this country. You don't put children in cages, not if you're a democratic country that takes care of its people and believes in humanity. I think that's the tone that you find in the national.
I want to just echo that. When Trump pulled out of the Iran agreement, the so-called JCPOA, the reaction in Europe ranged from astonishment to shock.
Yeah.
And if we are going to have a war between now and the 2020 election, I would say that Iran is number one on the list of places where we could find ourselves at war. I know a lot about Iran. I've visited there several times. I've reported on the U.S.-Iran relationship for many years. I'm extremely worried about the possibility of war between the United States and Iran, and so are the Europeans. They created a mechanism to get around U.S. sanctions called INSTEX, which would allow them to continue to trade with Iran because of the U.S. pressure on economic sanctions. And last month, I believe it was, both Secretary of State Pompeo and our Vice President Pence went to Europe and literally attacked the Europeans in public, saying that you are trying to get around our sanctions and we will stand for it. The Europeans went beyond shock and astonishment to outrage. If you look at the European press following that Warsaw summit and then the NATO event or the EU, I forget what it was, in Brussels, they were shocked, they were stunned, they were outraged. And yet, you know, Europe can't do that much to get around the crisis that the United States is deliberately trying to provoke vis-a-vis Iran, the latest move being declaring the entire Iran Revolutionary Guard to be a terrorist organization, which is clearly designed to provoke Iran, to undermine the moderates there, and to strengthen the hand of hardliners in Iran who want to themselves reject the JCPOA. And I've talked to the Iranians recently who say that's a real possibility, that they signed that agreement expecting to get economic relief. They got almost none. And now the hardliners who oppose that agreement inside Iran are saying, hey, we told you so. So there's a lot of pressure on
Supreme Leader Khamenei and the President and his Foreign Minister, who recently resigned and then came back to get out of this whole agreement, and obviously then to possibly resume their nuclear work.
Okay, thank you. We have a question related to the Ukraine, and the question is, please describe what the U.S. policy and activity was in the Ukraine before the current administration, and describe what the current administration is doing with respect to Ukraine.
Sanctions.
Since I mentioned Ukraine about 5 minutes ago, I just want to add a few more things. During the last administration, we had, big protest, but in forms of the peaceful manner inside the United Nations. And President Obama wanted to place economic and political sanctions on Russia. The problem is, we didn't have such a good, effective sanctions. It's far away country of Ukraine, and it was the last days of Obama presidency. But what we learned after the beginning of the new administration of President Trump, as I described earlier, it's just a quick change and 180 degrees, and we just consider Russia as one of the best countries in the world, and we have to maintain good business and political relationship. So I don't know whether there is any near future prospects of placing any hard economic political sanction, but I probably need more input to my colleague.
I mean, I think the question is something about Ukraine in the Obama administration. I mean, the situation that we're currently looking at in the Ukraine is, I think, at least provoked by the European Union's outreach to Ukraine. And Russia doesn't have much of a bloc left, but the Russian bloc includes the Ukraine. And it's not surprising, I think, to anybody who studies international relations that the EU outreach to the Ukraine, perhaps it's legitimate, but would be perceived by the Russians as threatening. So they seized the Crimea, and I don't see any prospects in getting this back, and I don't think the United States has options that are going to reverse that. And I suspect we will continue to see a fairly low-scale conflict in other parts of the Ukraine. And again, our options here are exceptionally limited. I think many people, at least the ones that are writing for my foreign policy class, are arguing for more and targeted sanctions on Russian elites so they can least feel the costs of this. The Trump administration is somewhat less inclined to do this than Congress presently. But even if a Democratic president comes in, I don't know what the Democratic president has on the table other than more continued targeted sanctions. Military options are just not realistic here.
Okay.
I want to make a comment on that too, if I might. I think the issue goes way beyond the European, the EU outreach to Ukraine. In 1990-91, when the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet Union was falling apart, James Baker, who was then the chief foreign policy advisor, Secretary of State to Bush 1, promised the Russians that NATO would not expand beyond Germany if the Russians okayed the unification of Germany under NATO. That was a huge concession by the Russians to allow Germany to join NATO if East Germany became part of West Germany. So, okay, what happened? The Clinton administration, thinking that it was world boss, pushed the expansion of NATO not only beyond Germany, but into Poland and Bulgaria, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, or what happened to Czechoslovakia, to various other Balkan states, and eventually between Clinton and Bush number two, wanted both Ukraine and Georgia to join NATO. Now that's the equivalent as if the Russians wanted Canada and Mexico to join the Warsaw Pact. It's absolutely ridiculous to imagine that Russia would tolerate two former SSRs. Remember, Poland and Hungary and Bulgaria, they were not SSRs. They were occupied Eastern Europe, or essentially occupied Eastern Europe. Georgia and Ukraine are completely different animals. So what happened? In 2008, there was a war in Georgia, which destabilized that country. Georgians themselves were largely to blame for it, but the Russians jumped in. There's no possibility that Georgia could join NATO while it's in the, because NATO would never admit a country that has a military civil war ongoing, or breakaway provinces and so forth. Ditto Ukraine. Now Obama said, he was smart enough to say, okay, we're going to suspend the Ukraine-Georgia-NATO push. But, you know, the Russians know that it's not going to go away. The Trump people are far less prepared to suspend that kind of NATO-Ukraine push or NATO-Georgia push, but it hasn't relaunched yet because, as I said, Ukraine could never join NATO if it's broken up in a civil war situation, and the Russians know that. So that's that. It's over. Now, as to sanctions on Russia, I mean, come on. Russia is a gigantic country. All we do if we put sanctions on Russia is to drive them toward China, which is what's happening, into a Russian-Chinese alliance. The way to solve the Ukraine problem is to send a smart diplomat, as if this administration could ever find one, to go to Moscow and say, okay, look, we want to settle this. The French and Germans know how to do it. You simply agree. We rule out forever and all time the idea of asking Ukraine to come into NATO. You in turn agree on some sort of federated solution in which Ukraine is neutral turf. We'll all get involved in supplying economic aid. We'll lift the sanctions, and you know, it'll be a major step toward fixing that problem. You can't sanction a gigantic country like Russia, which, by the way, is building a huge gas pipeline into Germany. The United States, oh, that's a bad idea. Well, try telling that to the Germans.
Thank you. Okay, we have a question from a student who asks, how does the media choose what to put on the front page? Are we still in a if it bleeds, it sells mentality? Does the media generally only write about stories that have U.S. interests?
Briefly speaking, international story reported in American news media in this country almost always involve U.S. as the main actor in the story. And any story that has some influence in our domestic policy and economy. And we all know, we are more interested in knowing what's happening in our own backyard rather than what's happening thousands of miles away. And some of the research in journalism and mass communication tells us that, most news stories carried in American news media almost always, just like where it bleeds, it leads, conflict, major wars, huge number of casualties. The farther away you have to compete with domestic news, so if there is a couple of people killed in Pakistan, it just doesn't land in American newspaper. It has to be 300 people killed in Pakistan.
I guess that's part of that's true for every news agency wherever in the world. You talk more about what's close to you than what's farther away. It's probably the same as your own coffee table discussions. You talk more about, let's say, Colorado than you talk about Oklahoma, just to mention one state, which is not very popular for me since I work on climate change and senator in North Carolina. So that's that example, Oklahoma. But I think in America there's something else going on. In the days that I was traveling in the U.S., when you didn't have social media yet, I was always struck how difficult it was for me as European to get my hands on news that actually interested me. And that included if I was able to find one of the better newspapers that are printed on the coastlines. Often you ended up with something like USA Today, which is, yes, the USA Today. It's today and it's USA. And it's not what will happen in a few years from now, and it's not about the EU. I never realized how good the title of that newspaper actually is. And I should tell them something. Okay, this will be next blog. But yeah, so that happens everywhere. But I think in being European, living in a small country, I mean, of course, if your own country is very small, then there's more countries abroad, right? So the news in the Netherlands, it's partly about Netherlands, but so much more is the international news. And also we have a bias. So for instance, in the Dutch newspapers, there's a lot of attention for what our parliament is doing and our government about rules in the Netherlands. Whereas we know that 70% of the regulations and laws in the Netherlands, they come from Brussels. But if you open a newspaper, there's much more information about our parliament, our parliamentarians, etc. The average Dutchman is not able to mention you more than one or two names of our representatives in the European Parliament or who are the commissioners or whatever. But most laws are made there. So we have that bias too. I tend to say that America is a bit worse off than we are.
Okay.
Not a journalist, but I guess one quick thought I had here. The question had something to do with the phrase, if it bleeds, it leads. And I guess what I might say as a social science researcher is that that phrase, to the extent that it's right, leads one to read the newspapers and I think believe that the world is coming to an end. And some of the discussion here today, I think, is consistent with this. But I guess if I can say something positive here, there are some quite positive international trends that don't really get much coverage. We are seeing, and have for a long period of time, rising average levels of GDP per capita, a fairly significant reduction in extreme poverty globally, but these don't produce news stories that we read regularly. Furthermore, we've talked about military conflict today and the possibility of it, but all the data in my field suggests that conflict, whether this is war between states, including civil wars, is on decline. It doesn't mean it's gone. But there are some very positive long-term trends. Now, there are reasons to be concerned that current events may disrupt these positive long-term trends, but they are there nonetheless.
It's really an issue of demand and not supply. If Americans wanted more news about international affairs, they'd get it. I want to defend the media on this in some ways, but I would also criticize the media for kind of not giving Americans what they need and not what they want. A big problem, however, in getting international news into the American media is that it's very expensive. And the news media is under incalculable financial pressure right now. By the way, when I speak about the media, I'm not talking about the idiotic talk shows on cable TV. But I'm talking about the serious top 20 or 25 publications from the New York Times to the Wall Street Journal all the way down to the Daily Beast and the Huffington Post and everything in between. I'm a freelance reporter. If I went to any of those publications and said, hey, I want to go to, Baluchistan to do a story, They would say no, because it would cost them thousands of dollars. They're closing their bureaus overseas. Of course, they're laying off hundreds of thousands of reporters, all over the country. Newspapers are shutting down. They're closing their international bureaus everywhere. Not because they don't want to have them there, because it's really expensive. To go to Afghanistan, I've never been, but to go to Afghanistan as a reporter, you have to have advance work, you have to have a security team, you have to have probably two automobiles, a translator and a fixer to arrange things for you. You have to have armed guards in many cases. So how much does that cost? You have to pay for all that. So we have a crisis in this country of the media, that the media is dying. It's dying before your eyes. And if we want to be left with blabbing idiots on TV as our only access for news plus Facebook, that's where we're going to end up if we don't start paying serious attention to how to fix the news business. And I mean, I'm too old now to worry about the far distant future. But I'll tell you, for a young person wanting to be a journalist, I've talked to a lot of CU students who want to be journalists. I'd be scared to death because this is an industry in real severe crisis, and we're going to be a dumbed down nation if we allow this to continue to unfold.
Were you going to respond?
Yeah, briefly on the previous comment. The planet, I know the positive stories as well, and I can do a full 2-hour class on the positive stories, on all the good things that happened in the past decades. But it's a bit like on the stock market, you know, that the results of the past are not necessarily a guarantee of what will happen in the future. What we do know for the very near future, in the next decades, is that there's one absolutely overwhelming, devastating problem that we have to face, and that is climate change. And climate change, it's amazing that we talk about the current news without mentioning climate change for an hour. That should be upfront everywhere, for every politician, every newspaper, that the house is on fire. We should do everything we can do to turn it off and save part of the house. If we wait for another decade, that small window that is still left that we can act is gone. What gives me hope is that I have more than 250,000 followers on Twitter. About 120,000 of them are Americans. Practically all my tweets are about the long term, are about international things. So the Americans go to places like what I'm providing in just little me with my Twitter account, but 120,000 Americans daily read about climate change, about biodiversity loss. They read about what's happening elsewhere in the world. So I'm a little journalist myself in providing this information. And I'm hopeful to see Americans following that kind of news. And I normally find them on the coastlines, but there's quite a concentration of boulder I noticed recently. Thanks.
Okay, and for the last question, we have a question from a student. And this is an interesting question, since we've been talking about all the chaos in the world and all the fighting and all the crises around the world. The student asks, is it safe for a woman to travel in the world right now? Specifically, is it more or less safe than it has been in the past?
I believe it's absolutely safer now than in the past. Of course, it depends where you go. Don't go to the outskirts of Karachi on your own as a woman, right? But the world has become, she just said, the world has become safer. The world has also become richer. I was just back in Thailand after I'd been backpacking there years ago. What I see on the growth and the development, and therefore also better institutions and better control, is massive. If you look at the people in the world that live like us, there's a number I mentioned yesterday, in the next 20 years, the people in the world that live like us, that have a car and eat meat and whatever, that grows from a little bit more than 2 billion to a little bit less than 5 billion. All these people live our lifestyles, and that is in reasonably safe areas. The people dying in wars has also consistently gone down. If you compare the first half of the 20th century with the second half, there are these kind of statistics that you can see. So these are kind of indications that look at, you can look at. As a woman traveling alone, Europe, North America, Southeast Asia, East Asia, there are massive regions. I mean, that's where a lot of people live, where it is safe. But be very well informed, because there are, in every country, areas where you shouldn't go, and there are some countries that should definitely not be on your list.
Texas isn't so safe either. So
Okay,
thank you. Thank you. I think that wraps it up for us. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you to the panelists. And there's lots more.